Good day, everyone, and welcome to Coronavirus and the Health System's Capacity, Protecting Frontline Health Workers. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question anytime by pressing star and one on your touchtone phone. And please note, today's call is being recorded. It's my pleasure to turn the conference over to Rachel Newsom. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon. And thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Coronavirus and Health System Capacity, Protecting Frontline Health Workers. I'm Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. Today's call is part one of the Commonwealth Fund Alliance for Health Policy series on health system capacity. Today, we'll look specifically at the capacity of our nation's healthcare workforce to meet current COVID-19 demand and projected surges that are already starting to show up in pockets across the country. We will address what can be done to ensure that we're protecting the health of the healthcare workers on the front lines of the outbreak and best practices from system leaders that have put these policies into practice. The pandemic will touch every corner of our health system, but we only have 30 minutes today, and we're going to be focused very specifically on ensuring the safety of our frontline health care providers. We plan to address other health policy-related aspects of system capacity, such as mobilizing the healthcare supply chain, in future briefings, hopefully later this week. I'm joined today by Ashish Jha, Professor and Dean for Global Strategy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, as well as Steve Perotti, Executive Vice President of the Permanente Medical Group at Kaiser Permanente. Ashish and Steve will provide some brief remarks on where our country stands right now in this pandemic, the most recent projections of demand on our healthcare system, and what can and should be done to protect the health of frontline health workers. As a reminder, we will take questions after your remarks, but you can enter the queue now for questions. Ashish, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. So hello, everybody. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. My name is Ashish Jha. I'm going to take a few minutes just to kind of at a high level tell you where we are as a country on this pandemic and where we are as health systems on this on the pandemic. So as I'm sure all of you are tracking, we have about 46,000 identified cases in the United States. And that makes us number three in the world in terms of number of cases. But it's rising rapidly as our testing infrastructure is starting to get up and running. We are testing right now about 60,000 to 70,000 people a day, or less we did yesterday, which is progress. So far from where we need to be, but we are making progress on testing. And most of us are expecting that within about a week, we will have more cases in the United States than any other country in the world, passing China. We're still early compared to China and Italy in terms of number of deaths, and so we have at least as of yesterday, about 500 deaths, and that number is going to continue to increase over the upcoming days and weeks as more people get sick from the virus and more people, and there are extra demands on our healthcare system. There have been a lot of projections on how ready our healthcare system is to take care of what is likely to be a large number of patients showing up with symptoms of COVID-19. Of course, every projection is influenced by a variety of factors, and I just want to lay out a couple that I think are important. One is what proportion of the American population will end up getting infected. Most epidemiologists have come in with ranges from, on the low end, 20% of American adults to the high end of 70% of American adults. And most of the modeling and data that we've looked at and done has assumed a 40% attack rate, because that sort of is in the middle, and that's where there's a lot of consensus that it will probably be that. Over what time period has a massive influence on the surge capacity of our hospitals and healthcare system to manage those patients? In Health Affairs blog last week and with ProPublica and New York Times, we published a bunch of models assuming that those infections happen either over 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months. Not projecting anything beyond 18 months because we're all have our fingers and toes crossed that we are going to have a vaccine by 18 months, and if we're lucky, a little bit sooner than that. What we know right now is that capacity to manage patients varies dramatically from community to community. Nationally, we estimate that there are about 750,000 hospital beds, and our primary models, which have looked at a 40% infection rate over a six-month period, require us to have will require that we actually end up having a lot more beds than we currently have right now across the country. We project that we will need about 274%. Actually, let me take one step back. One of the main models that we built, we assumed that hospitals across America could take 50% of their currently occupied patients, occupied beds, and discharge those patients by getting rid of elective surgeries, by getting rid of other marginally kind of critical cases, and open up 50% of their currently occupied beds. Our primary model asks the question, if 40% of Americans get infected over the next 6 months, what proportion of the beds that could become available would we need to take care of everybody? And the answer is we'd need about three times as many beds across the country as could be available. So obviously our strategy has to include opening up capacity, but that's not going to be nearly enough. We're going to need to find additional capacity across the country. The second big issue is we're going to need a lot more equipment in order to take care of all the people who are coming to the hospitals. New York is starting to feel this most acutely. And there are two buckets of equipment that I think about. One is ventilators for ICUs. Our best estimates are that there are about somewhere between 60 and 160,000 ventilators. I know that's a big range. I can get into details on why we have such a big range. But the projections that we have done, others have done, suggest that we may end up needing as many as 400,000 ventilators for the country. So whatever our range is, it's going to be clearly inadequate. And then the other big issue is personal protective equipment. But one of the things that we've seen in China, we've seen in Italy, is very high rates of infections of doctors and nurses. All of these beds, all of these ventilators do no good if there are not doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals to staff them and take care of them. So I think overall where we are as a country is we are starting to see New York as really the canary in the coal mine of starting to get into trouble with both ventilators, personal protective equipment, enough doctors, enough beds, not and nurses and beds. But this will roll across the country over the next 2, 3, 4 months. This is a challenge that I think we can rise to. There's a lot we can do, and there are a lot of creative ways we can meet the need that we have. But it will not happen without both bold leadership at the federal and at state levels, and I think a lot of leadership at individual hospital and health system levels. So big challenge, but I think it's something that we can conquer, and I'm happy to get into the details around any of this stuff in the Q&A, but let me turn it over to Steve to give a more, I think, on-the-ground perspective.
Thank you, Ashish. So Kaiser Permanente has really been on the front lines, both in Washington State and California, where those were the initial hot spots, and we had some experience with the initial response for the Princess cruise ships. What we've learned is that it is critically important that we have the right guidance around personal protective equipment and messaging that to the frontline staff and implementing enhanced droplet precautions for those individuals who are not requiring critical care and airborne type procedures, and then preserving the use of airborne N95 respirators and PAPRs and CAPRs for those individuals that are receiving the high-risk procedures. The second thing that has been critically important is turning on telehealth, which has contributed to the ability to have social distancing occur in our clinics, medical office buildings, and emergency departments. And in fact, we're implementing some telehealth procedures in the hospital setting so we can minimize the number of people going in and out of rooms and minimizing exposures for healthcare workers. The cancellation of elective surgeries has reduced the need for ICU beds, ventilators that would otherwise be used for the elective procedures, and preparing for that coming surge. Increasing the testing capabilities so that we can actually identify which patients need the personal protective equipment used and which ones don't in the inpatient setting, and increasingly being able to ramp up testing on the outpatient side so we can have a better idea and inform some of the models that Ashish was talking about in terms of increasing the hospital capacity. There's been a great deal of work done to increase hospital bed capacity to the levels that you've heard referenced in New York, both with existing infrastructure as well as infrastructure with additional hospitals that need to be brought online, as well as other venues of care, including hotels. This has been a public-private partnership at the state level with healthcare systems to be able to bring online other alternative venues of care, having tents, having mobile hospital units available to prepare for the surge is going to be critically important. And Kaiser Permanente, and I know other health systems along with us, are working to make those occur. Looking at standards of care where we have flexibility to provide care with alternative personnel. So using intensivists as strategic telehealth providers for hospitalists so we can provide more intensive care to scale. And a great deal of work being done to source personal protective equipment so we have adequate supply. And while we're waiting for that adequate resupply, implementing CDC guidance so that we have the ability to reuse, extend the use of N95 respirators and other personal protective equipment so that we can cover the potential shortfall for that resupply. And all of those are being implemented now in anticipation of the surge coming in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And the last thing that I'll just comment on is that we are working hand in glove both with CDC as well as our state health departments to ensure that the public health distancing measures are fully implemented. And I just want to cite for you some California data that's specific to sort of the canary in the coal mine. We actually can track cold, cough, and flu calls into our call center. And before the social distancing measures were put in place, we were receiving about 14,000 calls a day related to cold, cough, and flu. And over the past week, since California implemented its strict social distancing measures, those have reduced down to 4,000 a day. And so I think that's emblematic of the fact that we actually need to push these first line of defense measures when it comes to social distancing. The public health measures are just as important as the preparatory measures to make sure we've got PPE and protection for our healthcare workers.
Great. Thank you so much, Steve. I think we're ready to move to our first question. I see a question queued up.
Yes, but I'd like to remind our callers, it is star 1 for questions. And we can go first to Jack DiMatteo. Please go ahead, Jack.
Hi, this is Jack DiMatteo. I'm in the office of Congresswoman Lauren Underwood. Thank you guys for putting on this briefing today. One question that we've been getting from people in our community is the effectiveness of some of these makeshift PPE solutions. Steve, you mentioned the CDC guidelines on preserving N95 respirators. We also know that they mentioned the possibility of using scarves and bandanas. And we've been hearing people in our district who are interested in helping by sewing masks and things of that nature, but we're really hesitant to encourage this without an evidence base that they're actually working. So I was wondering if you might be able to speak to whether this is a solution that should be encouraging as we simultaneously work to unleash federal resources to get real PPE to the front lines. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So in terms of the PPE, there's medical grade level PPE that we absolutely want to preserve for the clinical care delivery system. There are reports from China that the use of masks that are homemade and or manufactured in bulk, and since you're speaking from a congresswoman's district, I would emphasize that it's important that actually we start activating around domestic production of both medical-grade PPE and PPE that can be used. And actually, it's not PPE. It's really masks that can protect against cold and cough and the spread of droplets. And there is, you know, some evidence that using those types of masks for individuals that are traversing through hallways, through cafeterias, that can reduce the potential spread. But reserving those for the use in community settings as opposed to use in the medical setting, I think, is the distinction that we want to make here.
Yeah,
so Steve, just to clarify. Sorry, go ahead, Ashish.
No, I was just going to say, I think the recommendation from the CDC that providers, doctors and nurses consider using bandanas as sort of a last, first of all, I think that was a big miss by the CDC. It's mostly been met with derision for good reason. There is no evidence that bandanas protect doctors in the context of a potentially lethal droplet and maybe airborne illness. So I think in general, we've got to protect our doctors and nurses with real equipment as opposed to makeshift or hand-sewn, only because there's no evidence base to suggest that those are reasonable alternatives. And so until there is such an evidence base, we have to assume that handmade products are no better than not having any kind of protection at all. And I think that's where most of the medical community is right now, for providers on the front line taking care of patients with COVID, just to be very clear, or potential COVID.
Yeah, and I think I want to reinforce that with what Ashish is saying. I mean, we first of all, have medical-grade equipment in the United States, and we have methods that I was just referring to earlier in terms of reuse, extended use, and use of the materials that are coming from the strategic national stockpile. Those are the things that we should be using for our healthcare workers. The makeshift masks are really for, at best, use in general public settings, not in the medical community for clinical care.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Lynn Anderson. Please go ahead.
Hello, and thank you all very much for doing this. I'm with the conversation based in Boston. I'm interested in learning more about the ventilators and why we have a shortage of them. Is the amount that we have on hand now what would be typical during the flu season, and why aren't there more to be ready for an emergency like this?
So this is Ashish. Let me maybe start with that. The amount we have right now is pretty typical for the flu season. We have generally we have plenty. The flu ends up not causing ARDS, adult respiratory distress syndrome. That's the main kind of pulmonary complication of this disease. So much. I mean, it does a little, but not. So we've generally been adequately supplied. We have about 20,000 in the National Strategic Reserve. We have known for a long time that we would be hit by a pandemic that would require ventilatory support, and that's why we have 20,000 in the National Strategic Reserve. I think many of us for many years have said that's completely inadequate if we end up getting into a real pandemic, but the government has not. And these things are expensive, and it's expensive to just buy them, purchase them, and kind of keep them around. But, you know, we do that for lots of other things. We have a lot of military equipment that we hope we never use. In the same way we should have been doing it, but at this point we don't. And my guess is once we get through this pandemic, my hope is we'll never make that mistake again, but a little, you know, it's water under the bridge now.
How long does it take to make one, Ashish?
They're complicated machines, and the standard answer is it takes a couple of months for companies, 2-3 months to really ramp up production. Some of the biggest makers of ventilators might make 5,000 in a quarter, and they've said, you know, if they really ramp up, they could go to 10,000 in a quarter, 10,000 over 3 months. So those are the kinds of challenges we're thinking about, right? Is that we need hundreds of thousands in the next month or two. So unfortunately, obviously, a major part of the problem is that we didn't do anything for the last 2 months. So it's a lot of time lost. But that said, there is an effort to now retool automakers and other companies. And if a whole host of companies that don't generally make this get involved, we may not get through the entire challenge, but we might be able to get through, especially if we are also very good at shifting stuff around. So New York is hit today. If we can ship ventilators from around the country to New York And then when New York subsides, and let's say it's New Orleans in 4 weeks, we could ship ventilators from around the country to New Orleans. And those kinds of strategies also obviously substantially expand our supply.
The other thing I'll just comment on is that, you know, even despite all the limitations that Ashish was talking about, you know, we can repurpose other medical-grade equipment that we have in place right now. So, for example, CPAP machines, which are continuous positive airway pressure machines, can be repurposed to be used as ventilators. And so engaging the respiratory therapy community, engaging the pulmonology and critical care community, we can repurpose and use other equipment and safely provide mechanical ventilation while this manufacturing shortfall is addressed. And I would be remiss to not put in a plug for the Defense Production Act and moving forward with that so that there is, as Governor Cuomo has mentioned, there's teeth in moving the manufacturing community to produce medical-grade supplies. And it's not just the ventilators themselves. We need the tubing. We need all the other ancillary equipment to make sure that we can provide that care.
We'll take our next question from John Tozzi with Bloomberg. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing the call. We've heard a lot about beds and ventilators and PPE as factors that might limit the system capacity. I'm wondering if you could talk about the healthcare workforce as well. Have you modeled kind of the number of clinicians and, you know, particularly if clinicians are taken out of service because they get sick or because they're under quarantine, you know, at what point do we start to face just kind of workforce capacity in the hospital systems?
Yeah, it's a really good question. This is Ashish. We have not seen good modeling data on this, so we haven't been able to do it ourselves. We've thought a lot about it, and we actually spoke to some folks on the COVID task force at the White House, and they're thinking about this, trying to do this as well. The issue here is, There's a bunch. Look, just at the baseline, we're not going to have enough workers. If we just do a standard, the only intensivists in the ICU, only ICU trained nurses in the ICU, we're going to quickly run out of them. So the question is, how do you expand supply? And there's a whole bunch of thinking that's going into things like, can we have states say that anybody who's retired in the last 5 years, if they had a license in good standing, can get an automatic 3-month license or 6-month license. Essentially, no questions asked. You don't have to go back and fill out any new forms. That kind of stuff can bring a whole bunch of older providers back into the place. We may not want them to be taking care of COVID patients because they're, of course, going to be at high risk, but maybe they can take care of non-COVID patients so that we can have younger providers or the current workforce take care of COVID patients. That's one strategy. How do we up-tool current nurses who are not ICU nurses? What's adequate to get them to be able to be effective? These are all state level. Every state is trying to figure this stuff out on their own. I think, again, a little bit of federal leadership could be helpful here in trying to come up with some basic rules and standards, understanding that ultimately these are state decisions. There's a lot of ways of expanding supply of doctors, nurses, and other health professionals, respiratory therapists, et cetera. But but every state is trying to come up with its own strategy. And I know this because I've been on the phone with at least a half a dozen state health officials and political leaders just in the last 24 hours on this question. So no one has a good strategy and no one has good numbers on modeling, except we're not going to have enough is the bottom line.
And from the frontline perspective, I'll just tell you that we're looking at being able to provide basically specialty telemedicine capability. So there are not going to be enough intensivists to do business as usual. But you do have intensivists that can actually use their knowledge and provide that to hospitalists where we have a larger workforce to provide the critical care at different ratios than what we're used to doing in the United States. And then being able to backfill the hospitalists who are going to be doing critical care with physicians that are capable of providing the subspecialty or internal medicine care for the regular hospitalized patients. Because, by the way, right now, they're not doing the outpatient care because they're doing telehealth. And we've got a bunch of surgeons and ambulatory surgery units that aren't doing surgery now because we've actually suspended elective surgery. So then repurposing those individuals. So there's actually as I look at it, a found workforce that is, again, going to require coordination at the state level. And I can speak to my experience as well, that we are working with various governors, various state-level departments of public health to come together as an entire health system. So I'm not just speaking to Kaiser Permanente specifically, but all the health systems in a given state to make sure that we take the found workforce that already is licensed, that already is in use, and repurpose their skills and provide them the additional training and or specialty backup via telehealth to expand the ability to provide care. And it's not just specific to physicians. I'm including nursing, I'm including respiratory therapy and the other ancillary staff, and we're going to require state-level flexibility to be able to, you know, break through some of the current regulatory gridlock that exists in terms of the current standards of care so we can flex to a surge standard of care.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Samantha List. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Steve, I was hoping you could walk me through the discussions health system leaders are having on where to put up these alternative facilities or what alternative facilities in communities you can or can't use. And also, we've heard about stopping elective procedures, but have you all started discharging patients to prepare for a surge, and what types of patients, and how will that accelerate over time?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So there are multiple options when it comes to alternative sites of care. One is looking at your existing hospitals and repurposing spaces within those hospitals. So in fact, taking and dusting off your surge plans and looking at, you know, spaces like cafeterias, like conference rooms that have the power and the plumbing to be able to put beds in those places where you've got staff already co-located. The second order is actually opening up tents, and tents can take the form of testing, triage sites, or actual mobile hospitals, and working with the National Guard, working with the Department of Defense, depending on, again, the state capabilities as well as the federal government's ability to assist is sort of the next order of business. Taking other hospitals that right now are not in use and bringing them up online are other methods that I'm seeing being done with the states. The third venue of care is actually utilizing beds that we might not have even traditionally thought of. You know, so a hospital ship, for example, is another way that we can expand that utilization. When it comes to post-acute care, actually repurposing hotels so that they could be used instead of a skilled nursing facility that doesn't have the capability of isolation, being able to use those individual rooms for isolation for COVID-positive individuals. Or if they don't have COVID, actually having a hotel designated for non-COVID patients so that you, again, decrease the risk of transmission. All of these levers, in my estimation, are going to need to be pulled because, again, based on the New York experience, based on a little bit of what Ashish was talking about, that's the only way that you get to the 2 to 3 times number of beds that we're going to need to be able to respond to this surge.
Thank you. And we go next to Priyanka Dayal McCloskey. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering about healthcare workers becoming infected in other countries like Italy and China, which Ashish just touched on. What does that tell us about what to expect here in terms of healthcare workers becoming infected? And do we have a sense, is it mostly because of lack of PPE, or were they also just at risk of being out in the community?
Great question, Priyanka. So look, in China, there were really two phases. Phase one was when a ton of healthcare workers got infected before they became very, very aggressive with PPEs and really went kind of full body suit top to bottom, at which point the rate of infection went dramatically down. Obviously, healthcare workers are still at risk for all the other things that all other humans are, but obviously they're at much higher risk for what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. So then Italy, our best understanding of the high rates of infection is really because of a combination of inadequate PPEs and fatigue and just long work hours, multiple shifts. People start getting tired and they just end up being a little bit less vigilant and can make mistakes. So if we're going to avoid that fate here, then PPEs are not optional. Bandanas are not optional. We need full body kind of PPE for once you've got patients who are identified as having COVID. There is emerging evidence that this issue around masks versus N95 respirators, there is some evidence that we should only be using N95 respirators for all suspected COVID patients because it's not just droplets. There may be enough airborne virus. If that really comes to be, that's going to put us even further behind the eight ball on in terms of having adequate protection. So this is an issue I'm deeply worried about because it creates a cascade where once healthcare workers start getting sick, everybody else has to work more hours, which increases their risk. And that gets us into a vicious cycle. And we've got to do whatever we can to try to avoid that vicious cycle. It's going to get very hard to take care of patients.
Thank you. We'll go next to Stephanie Goldberg. Please go ahead. Your line's open.
Hi. Thanks for taking the time. This has been touched on, but I just wanted to circle back. So Illinois and other states are considering opening field hospitals or recently shuttered hospitals to add capacity. I'm curious how those new venues are going to work, though, given the shortages of equipment and also providers.
I think you're raising a very important question. And so it's one thing to have the infrastructure, which is what I was touching on, and then you have to have the people and you have to have the materials and equipment. And all of those have to be sourced. And so some of this is easier to source than others. And a little bit goes into the planning of what exactly you're going to use these other alternative venues for. And so depending on where your shortfalls are, you may choose to use those alternative venues as standard care as opposed to intensive care. And you might use those as non-COVID sites as opposed to COVID sites. And again, some of that is dependent on the particular supply chain considerations in a given state or even within a given locale and a health system perspective. So all of that logistical planning has to be put in place based on, number one, local epidemiology, and number two, local infrastructure and supply capability.
Thank you. We'll go next to Blake Dodge. Please go ahead. Your line's open.
Hi, everyone. I'm Blake Dodge. I'm a healthcare reporter with Business Insider. Wondering if you guys could summarize what assistance you are getting from the federal government and what assistance you are not getting from the federal government, despite maybe some promises by the Trump administration that you would.
So we are working closely with largely it's the state authorities. So any kind of releases from the national strategic stockpile comes back to the state and then locally actually through the municipal health departments. I can tell you that the partnership with both the municipal health departments as well as state health departments has been strong. We have received some supplies from the national strategic stockpile. There are limitations just simply on what the strategic national stockpile has. And I think they have been aggressive about releasing what they have available in terms of masks, swabs, and other types of material. We just need more, and we need more manufactured. And so I can't emphasize enough the importance of the moves that are being taken right now to increase domestic manufacturing of these supplies. And the more that can be done at a statutory level and executive order level would be welcome.
And this is Ashish. I just want to add one quick thing. Part of what's really important to understand on a big picture level
is that a lot of these equipment have a global supply chain, have been manufactured elsewhere. So for instance, my understanding is that about 50% of all face masks that we used to consume in the U.S. healthcare system, let's say 6 months ago, came from China. Obviously, China stopped its exports when its outbreak got bad in Hubei province and elsewhere, and now they are resuming their product exports. But, you know, America is not at the top of the list of countries that China is exporting to. So, and we are now in a situation where we're competing with Western European countries and others to try to get this material. So there really is no choice but to substantially increase domestic production, because we're not going to be able to go out into a global marketplace and get it anytime super soon, because this is a global pandemic, not an American epidemic.
Thank you.
Would
I like to now turn the call back to Rachel Newsom for closing remarks.
Thank you so much. First of all, I just want to, again, thank our speakers, Ashish Jha, Steve Brody, for joining us. Thank all of you for staying on with us a little bit longer. I know everyone is really busy and many demands on their time, and we appreciate you being with us today. Just a reminder that we have recorded this call, and it'll be available on the Commonwealth Fund's website. If you had any questions we didn't get to, apologies for that. Please feel free to reach out to us via email. And as I mentioned, we will hold additional teleconferences around our response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we hope this one's been useful. Thank you and stay well.